So good morning. Continuing on our discussion of the Passion narratives, last week we talked about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane and his arrest. So Jesus has been arrested and has been carried off now, and that's where we pick up the story. In Matthew chapter 26, beginning at verse 57. And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat down with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow said, 'I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" And the high priest arose and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "It is as you say. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have all heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, O Christ, who is the one who struck you?" Okay. The whole process of Jesus' trial is a little difficult to follow. It seems to have fallen into three parts. The first part took place after the arrest in the garden, which we just described. The second part take place first thing in the morning, which we'll get to right at the beginning of chapter 27. And then the third part is, of course, the trial before Pontius Pilate, which is described a little later in the next chapter. The important question for us at this point is this. This meeting in the night, was it an official meeting of the Sanhedrin, or was it just sort of a preliminary thing to figure out the charges that needed to be made when the Sanhedrin formally met in the morning? You see, because the Sanhedrin was the Supreme Court of the Jews, it followed protocols. There were certain legal procedures that had to be followed in order for trials to take place. And if this was, in fact, a trial of Jesus taking place at night, it was a very serious breach of the Sanhedrin's own rules. And in fact, it rendered the entire verdict invalid, in point of fact. Okay? So it looks, because Matthew says that the whole council sought testimony against Jesus. So Matthew implies that it is a formal meeting of the Sanhedrin. All right. Let's look at it first from the Jewish legal point of view. As I say, the Sanhedrin was the Supreme Court of the Jews. It was composed of scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, the elders of the people, 70 of them. And the chairman or the president of the Sanhedrin was the high priest. So you had 71 scholars, Jewish scholars, who were formed this court, okay? And for a trial like this, the necessary quorum was at least 23 members. So at least 23 members had to be present, and the high priest, for it to even begin. And there were regulations. All criminal cases had to be tried during the daytime and must be completed during the daytime. This goes back to the very general understanding of Jewish law, that there were laws appropriate to men, laws appropriate to women. There were laws that were to be followed all the time, and there were laws that were only to be observed during the day, like laws that pertain to jobs and employment. Since most people only work during the day, they could only be fulfilled in the daytime. Courts of law were daytime activities and were specified they could only take place in the daytime. Okay, you couldn't have a court at night. It would be like us, you know, waking up and hearing on the news in the morning that the Supreme Court decided to convene at 2 a.m., you know, to hear some kind of a case. What's up with that? It doesn't happen, okay? This doesn't happen. And remember that Matthew especially is writing to a Christian audience that was made up of Jewish Christians. They knew the way that things worked, and so this is scandalous to them to hear this kind of an account. Okay? So criminal cases could not be transacted during Passover season at all. And only if the verdict was not guilty could a case be finished on the same day that it was begun. If there was a guilty verdict reached, the Sanhedrin would adjourn and they would allow all of the court, you know, sort of to spend the evening and, you know, to go to bed that night and to come back the next day in case feelings of sympathy, to allow time for feelings of sympathy or compassion to arise, so that they would not be, you know, so angry at something that they would impose too harsh of a sentence. So if you were not guilty, you could be dismissed that day. If you were guilty, you had to wait 24 hours before they would pronounce verdict. Okay? So that was for people's, you know, good. That was to help out those who were you know, accused. As we see, that didn't happen in Jesus' case. All right, no decision of the Sanhedrin was valid unless it met in its own meeting place, the Hall of Hewn Stone in the temple precincts. It appeared that this took place in the high priest's house because that's where Peter went to see the end. All right? All evidence had to be guaranteed by two witnesses, examined separately, having no contact with each other. False witnessing was punishable by death. Okay? The seriousness of the occasion was impressed upon any witness in the case where life was at stake. All right? Because in Jewish thought, if you condemn somebody to death, or if your witness, your testimony, causes someone to be put to death, in Jewish thought, if you killed a person, you don't just kill that person, you kill all of his potential offspring down to the end of time. Okay? So that's how serious it was. So false witnessing was an extremely serious offense to the Jews. Still further, in any trial, the process began by, first of all the evidence for the innocence of the accused had to be presented first before any evidence of his guilt had to be presented. And in the case of Christ, of course, no evidence for his innocence was put forth at all. These were the Sanhedrin's own rules. And it's abundantly clear that in their eagerness to get rid of Jesus, you know, they clearly broke their rules. Yes, Tom?
If the Sanhedrin is the Supreme Court, are they accountable to Rome? Why did they have to go to court?
Because at that time, under Roman occupation, the Jewish Sanhedrin was not allowed to impose a capital punishment. Only the Roman authorities could do that. And so Jesus needed not only a religious trial in order to fulfill prophecy and all, but he also needed a civil trial in order for the death penalty to be imposed and carried out. You know, the Sanhedrin could say that he was guilty of death, but they had to take the case to Pilate and say, here, by our own laws, this is what has to happen. Please issue a death warrant. And then Pilate would issue the death warrant. Okay? Yeah. So the main business of this night meeting of the Jewish authorities was to formulate a charge against Jesus. As we have seen, evidence had to be guaranteed by two witnesses, separately examined. Finally, they found a couple of false witnesses, but even they couldn't even agree on what it was that Jesus had said, which, you know, is sort of disappointing for all preachers when, you know, even Jesus is teaching daily in the temple and nobody can tell, you know, what it was he said and repeat it clearly. So, you know, if they couldn't remember what Jesus said, I don't, you know, why should I care too much if you don't get everything I say? It's all right. But the high priest, you know, finally asks his vital question. We knew that Jesus reportedly warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Maybe Judas had told the Jewish authorities this or something about it, you know, when he betrayed Jesus. But finally, the crux of the matter, the nub, finally comes to the point. The high priest stands up and charges Jesus with an oath. Tell us, are you the Son of the Messiah? Are you the Son of the Blessed? Are you the Son of Heaven? Are you the Son of God? All right? That's the real crux of the matter, okay? If Jesus says no, the bottom falls out of the trial and there's no charge against him. He had only to say no and he would walk out free. On the other hand, if he says yes, he would be signing his own death warrant. Nothing more than a simple yes was needed to assure his condemnation and his death. So what does Jesus do? He says the same thing that he said before when people questioned him. He says, you say so. He neither affirms it nor denies it. He says, you said so. But then he goes on and does something that really ticks off the Jews. He goes and he quotes Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, a very well-known messianic passage. But I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power, which means the right hand of God, and coming on the clouds of heaven. Everybody knew that that was a reference to the Messiah. And when Jesus says that in this context, they know he's referring to himself. And that's it. Immediately, blasphemy, blasphemy. He's committed blasphemy. People rent their garments in a kind of hysterical outrage at what he had dared to say there. And then Jesus was, of course, immediately condemned to death because the penalty for blasphemy was death in ancient Israel. And then followed all the spitting and the buffeting and slapping his face and the mockery and all that. So what started out as a court of justice, ostensibly, devolves just into a mob at this point. So any semblance of order or propriety is out the window now, and there's nothing left of it here. So that's, anyway, that's what happened that night then at the trial of Jesus. And again, yeah?
I'm just wondering what, like in this case, why was that specifically considered a blasphemy? Because they didn't have the understanding that the Messiah would actually be God incarnate. So, like, he's not claiming that specifically.
No, he's not claiming specifically to be God incarnate, but he is claiming to be the Messiah.
Right. Why is that?
Because they knew he wasn't. And in, as we see from the popular misunderstanding of who the Messiah was supposed to be, that he would be a political leader, that he would rule Israel like David the king of old would do, which would necessarily mean overthrowing the Romans and all. Any claim of messiahship was extremely dangerous. This is what you remember, I think it's in John's gospel, when the high priest becomes a prophet and says it is more expedient for one man to die for the people. You know, all I can do is the passage from Jesus Christ Superstar is right on the tip of my tongue because they put it so well, you know, in there. You know, have you no understanding? You know, he'll come in, the Romans will crush this, it'll cause all kinds of trouble and all. We can't have anybody, you know, upsetting the whole thing. So anyway, for them, the Messiah was more of a political figure anyway. So anyway, just any claim of that, they knew he wasn't that. It didn't fit their plans or anything, so it's simply blasphemy to claim to be the Messiah. It's best I can answer you there. The line from Jesus Christ Superstar will come to me sometime in the middle of liturgy. I'll try not to belt it out, you know, when I get there. By the way, the old classic one is worth watching again during Great Lent. Many years I always watched it during Lent. Yeah, you don't watch Jesus Christ Superstar for the theology. Please don't do that. But the singing is stupendous, and seeing things from a slightly different perspective, from Judas's perspective, raises some really interesting questions about the Passion narrative that are worth thinking on, you know, particularly as we get closer to Holy Week. I've always found it edifying in that respect. Let's go on to Peter's denials. So Peter is followed along here. Peter's sitting outside in the courtyard. Okay, in those in ancient Israel, well-to-do Jews built houses on the Roman model, which was always a courtyard, which were set up so that you had a central open space and the house was a square around it and all the rooms opened out onto the courtyard. You very often had a covered walkway that went around, a peristyle that went around so that you wouldn't have to get out in the rain when you came out of the bedroom and went into the kitchen, for example. But there was always an open courtyard, very often with a fountain or someplace like that. It made for very cool homes. And so Peter has come inside the middle of the high priest's house and is in the courtyard, which is in the center of the house. Okay. So a servant girl come to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I don't know what you're saying." And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." But he again denied it with an oath, "I don't know the man." And a little later, those who stood by and came up and said to Peter, "Surely you're one of them, for your speech betrays you." Then he began to curse and to swear, saying, "I do not know the man." Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So he went out and wept bitterly. This passage of Peter's denial is one of the most brutally honest passages in the New Testament. The first century, early second century, Bishop of Hierapolis, Papias, who wrote extensively. We have only a few small fragments of what Papias wrote. But Papias tells us that Mark's gospel was just the preaching of Peter. That's basically it. So what Peter preached, that's what Mark wrote down. And I should have put Mark's account of Jesus' denial because it's even harsher than what's in Matthew. And so if that's the case, then Peter himself, we know about Peter's triple denial of Jesus at the high priest's courtyard because Peter himself told the story. Now, you would think that if the church was going to make up all of this stuff and that the Gospels were fiction, you would want all of the main characters to look pretty good. And you would never include a story that was so critical of someone as important as Peter. You'd want to make him look sharp. And you'd cover over this kind of stuff. But the very fact that the Gospel records even these most embarrassing details about the most important followers of Jesus, many scholars say this points to the authenticity and the truth of what the Gospel's about. That they're not even willing to gloss over or to cover up unpleasant things in order to tell the whole story. They're going to tell it raw, even if it looks badly upon some of the people involved. And I think that's a nice argument. Peter is here. It took a lot of courage, really, to go in. He had been seen in the garden. He was known as a follower of Jesus. All of the disciples forsook Jesus and fled. Peter must have thought better of it and decided to follow along. So he's got a little bit of courage here. Okay? So he's in the courtyard. I think in John's Gospel it says that he was warming himself by a fire because the night was cold, like very often it is at Pascha time. It's still a little early, so it's cold. So he was there warming himself by the braziers. You know, they didn't have indoor heating. Not every place could have a fireplace or whatnot. So they very often used braziers full of coals. And even in large houses, they would have one room that would be set aside where they'd put a big brazier. People would go in there and warm themselves, and then they would run off, you know, run, jump in bed while they were still warm, you know, and then let the covers keep them warm. But bedrooms with heating in them was not real common, you know, in those days. And besides, charcoal fires made for carbon monoxide and for, you know, carbon dioxide, and you know, people suffocated, you know, in enclosed places. So trying to keep warm in the winter could also be a little dangerous. Anyway, that's off the point. Peter's there, he's warming his hands, and some servant girl comes up and recognized him. Maybe someone who had either seen him with Jesus before, or maybe had been at the Garden of Gethsemane. Peter denies it, and you'd think that he would probably have run away. And I think Peter thought to run away, because now he goes out to the porch. Okay, he's been in the courtyard. He says, no, I don't know the man. Oops, it's getting a little hot in here. People recognize me. Well, maybe this was a mistake. So he looks to leave, but he can't leave. As far as he can go is the porch. So he stands on the porch now, further removed, and another servant girl comes up and says to him, surely you were with him. You know, you're one of them. He says, no. He says, yeah, you've got to be, because your speech betrays you. Apparently, the Galilean spoke with a real clear accent. Okay? Some sort of drawl or something that distinguished them from people who lived in Palestine proper. So he must have sounded like a hick, okay? In fact, Galilean accent was considered so raw that Galileans were not allowed to give the benediction at the synagogue on Shabbat, because those were holy words and the Galileans couldn't pronounce them well enough to say them in public. That's how awful it was, okay? So I'm told. So, Peter is clearly not a local boy. He's a hick from Galilee, and Jesus was from Galilee as well. So, you know, that his speech gives him away. That's what that means. And so once again, Peter denies it, and denies it a third time. And then the cock crowed. Now, the business about the cock crowing. Traditionally, if it is a cock crowing, then this puts the time of these events happening at just before dawn. Because if you've ever been around roosters, they start crowing about an hour before the sun comes up, okay? And I remember in Texas, there were a number of morning birds that would begin chirping 30 minutes before the sun came up. And so maybe that's where I got in the habit of waking up about 5 a.m. But at any rate, so the cock would have been there about 4 a.m. or something like that. But there might even be another interpretation. The question of having chickens and roosters inside the crowded city of Jerusalem is a question that people raised. And in point of fact, there seems to be some evidence that in ancient times you were not allowed to keep chickens and roosters in the city. They were just dirty, they defiled the offerings, nobody wanted those nasty things around, there wasn't that much room for them because the city itself was kind of crowded. Where then would you get a rooster to crow if there were none in the city to be crowing? And the answer is this. I've told you that the Romans and the Jews divided the time into watches. Each watch was 3 hours long. So the first watch of the night starts at 6 p.m. and ends at 9 p.m. The second watch starts at 9 and ends at midnight. The third watch starts at midnight and ends at 3 a.m. And then the fourth watch ends at 6 in the morning. Okay. In Jerusalem, there was the castle of Antonia, which is where the Roman guard stayed. And the changing of the guard happened every 3 hours at 6, 9, 12, and 3. And the 3 a.m. change was called the Gallicinium, the cock crow. And what they would do is that every time that the guard changed, the trumpet would blow to announce that it was time to change the guards at all the gates and everything. And that might have been it. So cock crow might have been the changing of the guard at 3 a.m. And it was the trumpet blast that sounded there to indicate it. So maybe that might be it. If not, a rooster crows somewhere and Peter remembers what the Lord had said. Either way, you know, both are kind of nice interpretations of it. What happens to Peter after this, we don't really know. He doesn't show up again in the story until a little bit later on. But what is good to remember, though, here is that, yeah, Peter denies the Lord. He's kind of a coward in that respect, but you have to give him real credit for having the courage to go pretty much into the lion's den, to go into the danger, not to run away completely. He made it as far as the porch, but his love for his Lord kept him there regardless. He just could not leave. And that says something about Peter, and that needs to be chalked up to his credit. Okay? Let's look at the third bit here. Jesus is delivered to Pilate. So here's chapter 27. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. All right, so the morning came, all the chief priests and elders. So this would be like, a formal meeting of the Sanhedrin. Is this the place where Jesus' trial actually took place, or did it take place during the night? Matthew suggests that it took place during the night. So this might be just sort of, you know, formal arraignment paperwork and all of that, signed, sealed, and delivered. Besides, the Romans weren't going to be up in the middle of the night doing business anyway, so we have to wait for the Roman courts to open as well. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful. Again, you know, this goes back to the real question. If Judas wanted Jesus to be done away with, why would he be remorseful now? This is what gives rise to the question, what was Judas's real motive in betraying Jesus? It really muddies the waters and makes it more difficult to understand. We've talked about that. But he was remorseful, brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said to him, "What is that to us? You see to it. See to it yourself." And then he threw down the 30 pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. But the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the treasury because they are the price of blood." And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." All right. So here we have the poor end of Judas. Again, it's always kind of a blistering indictment on clergy to read this passage, because, you know, I as a priest, I see this. Someone has come in repentance and penitence, and in this case, the clergy rejected him. You know, you can't do that. You can't do that. If anyone asks your forgiveness, you got to forgive them. You can't say, "What is that to me? See to it yourself." And I think that what really drove Judas to suicide was despair, because he had come back and repented. He wanted to make right what he had done. He wanted to undo the mistake that he had made, and the clergy threw it in his face and said, "See to it yourself. We don't care. We don't care about that, and we don't care about you." So if you're ever in a position of authority, be real careful about the people who are under you, and this kind of attitude is devastating. Okay? So he goes out and he hangs himself, and it's curious. It's not real clear in English as it is in the Greek as to where he threw the money. Because we remember that There are kind of two words for temple in Greek. One is ieron, which implied just the temple precincts, which included all of the courtyards, the court of the priests, the court of the Jewish men, the court of the women, the court of the Gentiles, and all of that. And then there's the word naos, which meant the temple building itself, you know, proper, which was there in the center. And it says here that the place that Judas threw the money was into the naos, into the temple itself, not in the temple precincts. So what Judas did was, when he approached the temple, he went into the gate of the Gentiles, and he proceeded further. And he went in through the gate of the women, and he proceeded further. And he went into the gate for the men, and he proceeded further. And he had to stop at the gate of the priests. Beyond the gate of the priests, there was the temple building sitting there. There was the huge altar of sacrifice, which actually the altar of sacrifice was about 12 feet high and about 60 feet square. It was huge. I mean, they had, you know, we see these storybook and Bible illustrations. We think altars are little things, you know, where a man stands at it, like, you know, you're standing at a podium or something. No, they had thousands of sacrifices to offer. And the thing was really high, and it was about 60 feet square. It was that big, okay? So, but Judas goes right to the edge of that gate, and there are the priests inside ministering and preparing sacrifices and doing the priestly stuff. And he calls the priests, come, hey, come over here, because he can't go any further. But he calls them out and says, look, I've done wrong. I've betrayed innocent blood here. Take back the money. We got to fix this. And that's when they say, what's that to us? And so he throws the money at the temple. That's what he does. Okay? And then he runs out and goes and hangs himself. Okay, yeah?
Maybe.
He
said he had a sorrow in his heart and stuff. It sounded to me like he was a little repentant of what he did. But
yeah.
Or where was it that he, was it in the suicide that sealed his fate or what?
I think so. Because even, remember, Peter had just denied Christ. He went out and wept bitterly. Judas denies Christ, but goes out and hangs himself. So the response is different. And they're back to back here. So we're to see the contrast between them. There's always room for repentance. There's always room for restoration if we're willing to take it. This is why despair and turning your back on Christ is so deadly. It's really so deadly. You know, why we see it in our own day. You know, young people in despair, the ones who take their own lives. You know, it's really, really bad. Okay. We have to watch out for that. So at any rate, we see sort of the poor end of Judas. So that's it. I don't know what else to say about that. We need to stop about here anyway and get on with the hours because we have a catechumen to chrismate here before too long. All right? Thank you too much.